Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. What started off as a coffee chat has now grown into a global platform for visionaries. This morning, from Seoul, South Korea, we have the ex-country manager of Binance Korea and current co-head of Korea for Antler joining us. Please welcome Jiho Kang. Jiho, how are you this morning?
Very good, very good. Thanks for having me.
So Jiho, tell me about yourself and your background and how it led you to the path of joining Antler Korea as their co-head.
It's a long story. So I was born in Korea, but raised in the U.S. When I was much younger, finished middle school, high school, and then college back in South Korea. So I guess I do have a bit of a multicultural background. I guess ever since my first interactions with a computer was I think it was just very interesting that I was able to use like a box that's sitting on top of my desk to create stuff that can reach a lot of people that I have never even met before on the internet. So that's kind of, I guess, what got me into tech in general. I also kind of disliked the idea of working at another boring company, because I think I've had a lot of older family members, like my family, and I would observe them of as to how they would build their careers, and just thought to myself, you know, that doesn't seem very interesting. And I think that's when I started to meet up with a lot of people that were interested in building companies younger, when I was, say, my late teens. And that's, I guess, kind of how I decided to commit myself to trying to create my own job, like my own business. And I thought to myself, I mean, in the worst case scenario, I would be working at like a boring job. Best case scenario, I would be, you know, working at a company that I built. So that's kind of how I got started. It wasn't easy, obviously. So I probably started five to six, you know, startups in my career. The first one actually being when I was much younger, when I was like probably 17. But at the end of the day, I think I just decided that I would just continue to do this until I could no longer sustain myself like financially. And after, so I did have a small exit with a startup that I founded called Sumgo, which is still growing. Their latest round was a Series C. They were valued, I think their recent valuation was about a quarter billion, just under a quarter billion. And also following that startup, I started a company that was aiming to build a Korean won fiat-backed stablecoin, which again was acquired by Binance. Again, it wasn't like a huge exit, but again, it's just, I think it was exciting to kind of see a lot more people have access to like the Korean won stable token that we've built. And after Binance, I guess I kind of had a bit more time to reflect on myself, to really think about what I wanted to do, especially because at that time I had like a little bit of a newfound like personal financial stability. It really makes you think as to why you've been doing a lot of stuff that you've been doing up till now. And it wasn't purely for financial gains. And I think everyone has like a different set of criteria that they have in their minds before deciding on what they want to do. But I think Antler was just like anything financial aside, which I think I've come to the conclusion that it wasn't like a very huge driver for me. Antler was just interesting because it was solving a real problem that founders like myself had faced in the early days of trying to get a startup up and running. I thought that was a problem that was worth solving, and also a problem that I felt was in a very good position to, you know, help solve along with Antler.
And given this phenomenal background, as a rookie VC in Korea, how does Antler operate when it comes to evaluating these ultra early stage companies?
Right. So, yes, I am a rookie VC. The Antler Korea Fund is also a new fund and a new firm in Korea. But when you're investing ultra early, there's not a lot of stuff that you can kind of review. So for instance, if you are investing in, say, a Series A or a Series B startup, they probably have, say, 2 years or 3 years worth of some sort of data, like something that can that you can actually look into to see if they've been achieving growth over the short period of time that they've been in existence. But if you're investing in like seed or pre-seed, there's not a lot of data. So the only thing that you can, you know, take a look at is who the founders are, and which I think is as important as what type of business that the team is trying to build, if not more important. So I've seen multiple founders. I don't think I've ever seen a founding team go on to build what they originally thought they would build. That originally thought they would be building when they first started their business. So, I mean, you know, some pivot their business a little, some completely pivot their business into something entirely new. And the people who do that, who make the decision to do that for the better of the company is actually, you know, the founding team. So when you're investing super early and they don't have a lot to show for themselves yet, you have to really get to understand have to understand who the founders are, why they're doing this, how well have they been doing their job, like prior to them trying to do this new startup, like did they have an impact throughout their life? So you can kind of draw a trajectory of the individual founders of how much impact that they've had wherever they were, whether that be in school, whether that be in the workplace. You can kind of, if you really get to understand that, then I think you can build up the confidence to come to a decision whether or not you would want to invest in the team or not. And I think that's kind of it in a nutshell. So at Antler, because we want to better understand founders and understand how they tackle hard problems and how they communicate with each other, et cetera, the program, the we call it a startup generator program in Korea. It's set up so that the founders can come into the batch and work with the Antler Korea team to build their startups. So they would come in, they don't need to have a business model in mind, a business idea in mind. They don't need to have like a team yet. So they can come in just by themselves. As long as they have conviction that they want to, you know, build a very successful business. And they have to have shown, you know, what I was discussing earlier, how they've actually made a big impact until the point that they've actually decided to come into Antler. Before we invest in any team, they spend 3 months with us, looking, brainstorming good business ideas and building teams. And we observe, you know, the founders throughout this process to kind of understand, you know, who the best people are. And it's through that process that you know we identify which teams that we would like to invest in and which teams we don't. And I think it's a very different approach from, you know, the existing VCs, where they would probably go out and hunt for good, you know, investment deals and try to peer into, say, whatever limited amount of data that the founders can provide you over the course of maybe 2, 3, or 4 meetings, which I think is actually really high risk. So I think you can, in that sense, I think you can say that, you know, no other VC is kind of investing the way Antler does, at least in South Korea now. So I think that even though we are new, that kind of gives us a very strong advantage.
So Jiho, given this competitive advantage, currently Antler Korea has 2 partners. How does this lean team split their time when it comes to covering the whole deal flow process and recruiting startup talent effectively to ensure the team is helping them along their journey?
So I think there's a little bit of a misconception about what Antler actually does when it's managing a batch of founders in its startup generator program. So it's the founder's job to build businesses. It's not like the Antler team is coming up with ideas for the founders, or we're not telling founders who to team up with. It's more like Antler is providing just a physical platform for smart people to come together, share ideas, and, you know, kind of explore exciting business opportunities with like-minded people. And all that Antler does is kind of provide that platform and act as kind of like a moderator that allows founders to make the best of the time that they have allocated to them. So my typical day would involve probably 50% just talking to founders and giving them feedback. Like I don't have experience in like every field, right? So I have a very narrow skill set, I think, compared to the breadth of skills that our founders have in each batch. And I have a limited understanding on, you know, different industries, except for the ones that I've personally been involved in. So I don't have all the answers. It's just that I try to ask the right questions to help founders kind of, you know, focus on what types of questions and problems that they should be focusing on. Because there's, in the early days of founding a startup, there's just a lot of stuff that is constantly requires your attention. So yeah, I don't feel like I'm teaching anyone on how to do anything. Like, I would provide my experience and insight based on my experience. However, that doesn't mean that this is like the only right way to do things. So I don't know if you get what I'm getting at. So it's more, it's the founder's job to start their business. Antler provides the platform. We try to help them focus on the important stuff by asking the right questions and making sure that you know, they're always, I guess there's a little bit of push involved. So we try to make sure that there's always high tension within the group, so that, you know, we don't kind of slip into, say, a little bit of a lazy mentality, if you will. But yeah, that's about it. Gabriel and I, now that the Korea batch is in full swing, 50% of our time just goes to speaking with founders, and about 20%, I guess, goes to reviewing the feedback that the founders have been giving us, so that we can kind of come up with better ways to help them. And the rest is basically, you know, planning out what we're actually going to do, you know, in the following weeks, based on the feedback that the founders are providing us. So it's a constant learning process.
So given this startup incubation angle, I hear that Antler Korea is in the middle of the first batch. What exciting initiatives has the team been up to since the launch of Antler in Korea?
So we're still trying to close our fund. So our fund is it's a $25 million fund in USD. We've closed about a third of that recently, which is why we've been able to launch, you know, the first batch. The first batch will be able to get investment for that fund, but we're going to continue to, you know, try to attract new LP investors into the fund. And I think, you know, the first batch is very important to demonstrate that, you know, this model actually works. We have been demonstrating this in other offices across the world, but again, you know, in Korea it is new. So that's one of the key focuses that we have now, like making sure that the first batch can have a very strong start, which is again beneficial for the founders, but also beneficial for the fund that we're trying to close. And a bigger fund would allow us to invest into a lot more startups in South Korea. The stretch goal is to invest in at least 100 startups over the course of 4 years. And, you know, for Antlers, like strategically, that's very important. Like it's really hard to have a successful fund, especially if you're investing early, if you're only going to invest in say like 10 or 15 startups. Like it just doesn't work that way. Like you have to have a very diversified portfolio. And in order to do that, you know, the fund needs to be of a specific size. And I think like even YC, like I think they've invested in like over 3,000 startups over the course of like 10 or 15 years. About 2,000 of them have survived more than 5 years. And it's my understanding that about 80 to 90 startups have actually made unicorn status. So you need to have a healthy portfolio, a very diversified portfolio. So that's kind of the points that we're really focusing on at the moment. We're also trying to, I guess, pave the way for a new, you know, style of investing where, you know, we're actually creating like, I kind of feel like we're creating a factory where the input is very talented people and the output is investment grade, you know, startup teams, like strong teams. And like, I know that no one else in Korea has done this before. So hopefully we'll be able to make an impact. And we actually invite other VCs to kind of, you know, try this approach with Antler so that we can learn from each other. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at right now.
So Jiho, you alluded to earlier in the call just now, you have to have a certain fund size to be an effective investor and ensure that you get returns. Can you further clarify this? Meaning there has to be some sort of minimum that a fund should be raised at?
Well, I mean, so you should... For a fund, you should have at least, well, I mean, the Antler kind of rough guideline is you should have a diversified portfolio of at least 100 firms. And that means that if you have 100 firms in your portfolio, like if I go back to my YC example, I think for YC, it's like roughly 4% of their portfolio have actually gone unicorn. So if you have, say, 100 companies, and that means that like 4 companies have actually made it unicorn, the rest might not have survived, but the 4 that actually did make it unicorn will carry the returns for the entire fund. So at a minimum, that fund will probably, you know, return at least like 3x, because each unicorn in your portfolio will provide returns of 50 or 100x at least. So... You know, you have to have a large diversified portfolio, but I think in Korea, you see a lot of funds that invest in like 10 startups for the entire fund. That's kind of their portfolio. Like it's really hard to like, you know, bet that at least one is going to make a unicorn out of a batch of 10. And it's much more, I guess, like the risk is much lower if you have a diversified portfolio of 100. Because if you have a diversified portfolio of 100 and only one of them actually make it unicorn, you'd still like probably do pretty well.
So it's more on the sense of running that fund economics model before you raise the fund, taking into consideration your 2% management fee on average, mm-hmm. which fund Correct. Managers usually take, and then splitting it across the winners, the break-evens, and the losers.
Right. So, I mean, you're obviously going to continue to like double down on the winners, but you have to have like a very large pool to, you know, continuously follow up on. If you only have a like, if the only deals you have invested in are 10, then that's kind of, that's about it, right?
To basically be able to index it or ETF it in a sense.
That's correct. So, I mean, that's how you hedge early stage investments, I think. Like people ask me like, you know, isn't investing too early like risky? I mean, you know, most of them fail. And yeah, that is true. So, you know, your only hedge against that bet is to make a lot of bets, a lot of little bets. And I think in the early days, like 10 years ago, when like 500 was just getting started, YC was just getting started, there was more of like a spray and pray mentality. And that still worked up to a point until like everyone started to like spray and pray. So what's the next evolution of that? Like, you know, I think Dave McClure, the founder of 500, said in the early days, like his investment thesis was to make a lot, lots and lots of little bets. And again, like, you know, everyone started to take that approach in early stage investing. So what's the next evolution of that? Well, how do you know, you know, which teams are the strongest? How do you know like which founders are actually like the smart founders? And you can't know that by having like two or three meetings with them, which is why, you know, Antler insists on all of our founders coming in full time. If they have a job, they have to quit their job to come into our batch. And, you know, we actually observe how they work for 3 months before we make our investment decisions at the IC. And it's not just us like, you know, observing them. We also put in a lot of effort to try to make sure that they're in a very good position to, you know, raise money from the Antler funds.
And like YC, will there be a set check size for a set amount of equity into the company?
Correct. So Antler usually takes 10% equity, and the investment amount varies region from region. In Korea, the USD check size is about 150K for about 10% equity. And that's just a standard deal that we offer to all our founders coming in. And founders accept that because, again, like the target 2B founders that we reach out to during our recruitment is people that are just at absolute zero. Like they may have a couple of ideas as to what type of businesses that they want to build. Most of them don't have a co-founder yet. And you know, I think they understand that if they try to go it alone, it would take a lot more time. So the average YC company is about 18 months old. So, you know, that means that these founders have spent 18 months trying to get to a point where they have a strong team. They have a product and they have some sort of like proof that the market actually wants whatever they're building. And at Antler, the value proposition to our founders is that yes, Antler does invest at a lower valuation for a little bit of money, but we offer value in that we save you a lot of time. So, you know, what you might be able to achieve in like 18 months to 2 years, Antler helps you get that done in a period of 6 months and, you know, really saves the founders a lot of time and a lot of money in trying to just, you know, getting just the basic parts in the very beginning, like, you know, setting up your team, making sure that, you know, you have a very strong business proposition, attracting, you know, advisors and whatnot.
So Jiho, taking a turn into the conversation, you had this amazing opportunity to have founded six different startups in your career. with one still growing and one being an exit. As a VC on the other side of the table, what do you look for in a founder, and how has founding multiple companies helped further the startup evaluation process?
So I guess there's not an easy answer for this, but the shortest answer that I could probably give you is that if I were to start a new company, would I be willing to work with, you know, the person in front of me as co-founder? That's kind of like the one thing. And what I like to see in a founder is just, you know, basic grit and the ability to really think out of the box. And like, how do you know that? So I, in my interviews, I tend to go through kind of that person's life story. Like, I usually start from, if the person that I'm interviewing is younger, I would probably kind of ask how they grew up. You know, what were they doing when they were like 15 or in college, why they made those decisions, and kind of really trying to understand what motivates this person. And I think it's a very particular type of person that constantly looks at the world and just is curious and constantly wonders if there's, you know, a way to do things better. There's a problem, how they might be able to solve that problem, and understanding that although they might not have all the resources in the world, they still have the ability to make a positive impact. So it doesn't have to be something huge, right? But the little clues that I would want to try to pick up is, you know, what are the little things that this person has done throughout the course of his life that had a positive impact on the people around them? Did they actually go out of their way to make that happen? And whenever they were faced with a hard problem, did they kind of shy away from that problem, or did they really take it, you know, head on? And I think those are kind of the basic qualities that you want to see when you are deciding whether or not you want to work with this person as co-founder. And that's kind of the first litmus test that I would do before I would invite them into an Antler batch. And of course, after they come into the Antler batch, I would want to kind of observe how they do in action. And to your second point, how has founding multiple companies helped me do this? Well, I've worked with several different types of people, I guess, throughout my career founding different companies. And I don't think there's like a set formula, but I kind of feel like I've developed a sense of kind of evaluating how sincere you know, people are when they're trying to work on a specific problem. I see some people that, and don't get me wrong, I'm also guilty of this as well in my earlier days of building companies, but you get really excited about a specific idea that and it's good to be excited. It's just that I think there needs to be a balance of kind of making sure that you're in check with reality. Because if you're really excited about a specific idea, a very specific idea, then I tend to see founders don't listen enough to what their customers are saying, and you end up building like a product or a business that you want and not a product that your customers want. And it does take, I guess, it does take, or for me, it took failing multiple times at building startups before I actually realized this. And I also try to see if, you know, the people that are applying for Antler, when I'm in an interview, I would also ask what their like biggest failures are, because big failures are humbling, and it puts you in a position to really, you know, check in with reality. And again, it doesn't have to be like a huge failure, but it needs to be a failure like on a personal level that was really that has really impacted you. So that is also another thing that I try to look for. You don't have to have had like a catastrophic failure in your life, but just have how the person, what kind of like hardships or failures this person has had, not necessarily from an entrepreneurial standpoint, but during their life where they tried to do something, but things didn't actually turn out the way that they had liked, how they actually coped and dealt with that specific episode, and how they changed through that process is another thing that I would look for. And you know, everyone's story is different, so there's not like a clean cut formula in deciding whether or not, you know, this person is a good founder or a smart founder or not. But you know, I think the best founders kind of have a story that I can resonate with based on my own personal experience.
So early in your career, you started in consumer tech and moved into crypto. How did you make that move?
Well, I guess there was, to tell you the truth, there was a bit of FOMO. So I remember in like the late 2000s, I was working on a Web 2.0 service, which was what it was called back in the day. And we were building basically a web service that helped remote teams collaborate. And again, it was completely web-based. The iPhone had not been launched at the time. There wasn't like a thriving mobile ecosystem that we have now. And then I believe it was like probably late 2000s that, you know, Steve Jobs, Apple had come out with the first iPhone. And again, like a couple of years after they had launched that, they launched the App Store that allowed third-party developers to, you know, create amazing apps on the new platform. So I remember I kind of missed out on that. So I kind of did understand that, you know, there was a new platform out that could have provided a lot of new opportunities that for startups that didn't exist prior. But I just decided that I should walk the path that I had been walking and continue to push forward with the web-based service that I was developing at the time. And I remember all of my kind of indirect competitors at the time, they all moved over to mobile. Eventually, like as those companies grew bigger, you know, their web-based products didn't get too much attention, but again, their mobile products started to get a lot of attention. So I guess that kind of stung. And it's just something in the back of my head that kind of wished, maybe I should have kind of jumped onto the bandwagon a bit more earlier. And I had, you know, been aware of, you know, blockchain, Bitcoin since like 2013, because, you know, I remember when Bitcoin first hit like $100, I was curious, and just because I wanted to learn how everything worked, I remember I set up my own rigged to mine Litecoin at the time. So I did understand that it existed and that it could be, you know, something big someday, but I didn't really act on it until like, I believe it was 2017 or 2018, when things were getting really crazy and a lot of money was flowing into crypto. And you were starting to see, you know, some legitimate companies that were building on top of the new blockchain platform. If you look at blockchain, like as a whole, like a wide ecosystem and platform, and I guess a little bit of FOMO did kind of push me there. There was also, I guess, a sense of the company that I was working at the time, the startup that I founded, Sungo, which I was chief of product there. The company had already grown like a lot at that time. And, you know, the team was getting bigger and bigger. My daily routine changed a lot from, you know, actually building stuff and solving problems to, you know, managing people, which I guess I felt that other people could do a lot better than I did. Of course, I could have stayed more and try to see if I can learn the ropes of how to do that more effectively, but I felt like my strength were at getting from zero to one. And that the combination of those two kind of, I guess, pushed me into trying my hand at something new. So like I know I'm good at going from zero to one. So I'm going to start a new startup because Sumgo at the time was way past one. And the new platform or the new ecosystem, you know, the blockchain itself just seemed a very attainable and exciting opportunity at the time.
And speaking of going from zero to one, what is the biggest mistake founders make when building a team during this time?
So I can like list up some of the obvious ones. Like I see a lot of teams spending a lot of time arguing about how they want to like split equity amongst themselves. Like that's, I think that's kind of one of the most stupidest things that you can do early on. Like you don't really know what you're going to build. You don't know if the company is actually going to get funded or if it's going to continue to survive after like a year. But like if you've spent more than like a week just arguing with your founders on how to like split equity, then it's probably not a very good there's probably not very good chemistry in that team. And you know, if you trust your founders, then I think a lot of things can be fixed down the road, even if you don't have like the optimal equity split when you first begin. Like the goal is to create something bigger than, you know, than the team, the members of the team individually. So if everyone on the team agrees that that is like the ultimate goal, I don't think it really matters if I have like 1 or 2% more equity like than my other co-founders. And again, if you know, if there's an issue with compensation or motivation down the road when the company is actually doing better, that's actually a good problem to have. And if you trust your co-founders and if you selected them well, like you know, you there are ways that you can actually work those out. Another thing is founders, you know, they're very good at looking at the big picture and kind of drawing this this grand vision of how the future is going to be and how whatever company or product they're building is going to change how people do things. But it's very few founders who know how to break that down into the most like micro level, because you can't start huge. I mean, you're a startup, so you have to start small somehow. But it's easy to draw up a grand vision, but I think it's difficult to break that down into small pieces and figure out which of the small pieces are the most important to nail early on, because that is what's going to get you from zero to one. Like, some founders come to me saying, oh, we have this grand vision, we're going to change the world. And I ask, well, how are you going to do that? Like, what are you going to do in the next month or 2 months or 3 months? And they say, oh, we're going to build it. And I say, okay, if you build it, then how are you sure that, you know, you're going to acquire the number of users that you need to actually, you know, to actually execute? And there's not a lot of people that can answer that. They say, oh, we're going to, you know, spend this much amount of money and we're going to build it for 6 months or we're going to build it a year. But all right, then if it doesn't work out, if you're betting like a year of your life and other people's money and it doesn't work out, then you've just wasted like a year of your life and other people's money. So it's really important to for founders to figure out how they're going to test their ideas without spending a lot of time and money. And that's what's hard. Because a lot of times, like, you know, I talk with founders that say they need at least like, you know, a million active users for a lot of their assumptions to actually test their assumptions. Like, they need mass to test their assumptions, but how are you going to get mass, right? So it's the ability to look at something big and really like break it down into the smallest like levels that is actionable and is testable within the time frame of, say, like, I would say like 3 months max. And if an MVP takes more than a month to build, then that's not an MVP. Like, if you can build something in a month, within a month max, like, that's tops. And you can get an answer as to whether or not the market or your customers want your product or not within like a month and a half. That is an MVP. If you can't get that answer, that's not an MVP. And probably you haven't probably put in enough thought as to how to break it down even more.
And Jiho, having this whole conversation around the startups you started and crypto and building a team from zero to one, your last startup, which was amazing, was acquired by Binance, where, like you said before, you spent 1.5 years building a stable coin. Can you tell us a bit about what the process of building in crypto was like, along with the journey to getting acquired?
So I wouldn't say that particular startup was amazing.
Or maybe Binance just walked in and said, hey, I want to acquire you one day.
Well, I think I really do believe that a lot of the things that I've done were possible because of just like sheer luck. I just think I was consistent enough at it to kind of raise the probability of something lucky happening to me. So I think that's about it. But for the stablecoin startup of BXB, that was really difficult because I come from a consumer tech background. And when you're working in consumer tech, it's all about how you can like hack some sort of system or come up with a really scrappy or hacky way of solving a problem at like the very, like I was explaining earlier, at a very micro level. After I decided to work on a Korean won fiat backed startup, I quickly realized that, you know, you can't do this. You can't do that because it touches a lot in the finance sector. And again, like, finance is heavily regulated. For example, if you launch, say, an app that crashes all the time and people are complaining, like, it's not the end of the world. If people are complaining, then, you know, you can fix it. You can say you're sorry, you can go ahead and fix it. But if you build a product that involves other people's money and something doesn't work and people lose money, that's a completely different problem to have. And, you know, people can actually go to jail for doing something wrong or hacky or scrappy. So that's kind of the first thing that I realized, oh, this is not going to be easy when I first started. So we spent like a bulk of our time just like talking with lawyers and talking with, like, you know, people that have experience in, like, the financial sector, the regulatory sector. And that is also on me. I kind of think that I could have done more homework on this before I jumped in. But again, like, that was just a huge mess, and it took a lot longer than I had expected to get to a point where we actually were able to launch something. So, and with Binance, I think it was just sheer luck that we happened to have launched a fiat-backed Korean won stablecoin that was, like, I would say, I don't want to say was legal, but it wasn't illegal. We made it so that it was not illegal. It was just kind of in a gray area. And we had proven that it worked. Like, it did kind of maintain its peg in, like, the early tests that we've done with smaller exchanges. And the Korean, you know, exchanges, we had also contacted some of the Korean exchanges to see if they wanted to work with us, but they decided, oh, like, you know, kind of feels like it's way too risky to try to get into fiat-backed stable coins, especially, you know, within Korea. But Binance happened to be interested in the Korean market at the time. So, you know, I believe at first, one of my other co-founders approached Binance asking for an investment. So we were raising a round at the time. I believe it was a pre-series A round, or probably a series A round. So that's how we got in contact with Binance first. But they actually just told us, hey, like, you know, why don't you just give us the entire team in the product that you're working on? And at the time, like, I guess it made sense for us, because another thing that we had realized as we were building this is, if you don't have, like, a strong brand, it's just really hard to get people with deep pockets to kind of use your product. Again, it comes down to, you know, if it involves money and lots of it, people are a lot more conservative as to, you know, what kind of products that they choose to use. It's not like when you're building some sort of photo app. Like, you know, it's okay. I mean, people will try it out even if it's not great. And we can continue to improve on that. But as it turns out, it's not the case when you're working on something in fintech. And I guess for us, we felt like it was a good opportunity. So the ultimate goal was to build something, you know, bigger than us, bigger than the team. And in that case, when we were building a stablecoin, it was to make sure that we had built a stablecoin that was used by lots and lots of people. And we were actually hoping that it would solve, like, the kimchi premium problem that Korea had, because it was just so hard for foreigners to trade in Korea, and also for Korean traders to trade on exchanges outside of Korea. So that's kind of the problem that we were trying to solve. And it just made sense for us, because if we rebranded the stablecoin that we built as a Binance stablecoin, you know, that we obviously would have solved the issue of basic trust from our potential customers in what we're trying to build. So strategically, it worked out in the beginning. We had helped Binance to try to set up, you know, a lot of the basic stuff in operating in Korea. It's just good luck for us, I guess, in starting the relationship with Binance, but not too good luck for Binance, because later down the road, like, the Korean regulators started aggressively pushing for new new safeguards for Korean citizens that were trading crypto, and that was just kind of a huge, I guess, challenge for Binance that, you know, we weren't fully prepared for at the time.
And to wrap up a call with our last question for the day, what piece of advice would you give to people out there from the journey you have had thus far in life?
I would, well, so here's what I would say. Like, you know, what's what's the worst case scenario? Like, you know, I see a lot of people and they don't have a lot to lose. I mean, I think if you have, say, if you're not working paycheck to paycheck and you have some sort of buffer, like you can try to build something great, right? You have the opportunity to do that. If you're fortunate enough to not be working paycheck to paycheck, I think, you know, why not invest 3 months of your life, or why not invest 6 months of your life to try to tackle a really big problem that could, you know, grow into something amazing later down the road? Like the worst case scenario, you go back to, you know, just working your ordinary job. And I think that's, if there are a lot of people that are in that fortunate position, but don't really understand that they are in a fortunate position, but because there are a lot of people that are working paycheck to paycheck. And for Antler, like, I think we try to like provide a little bit more security in people that are willing to kind of, you know, bet on themselves. We Antler founders that come in, I mean, we provide them with like a stipend for 3 months during the first 3 months of their journey. It's not a lot of money, but in USD, we probably give them like $800 a month for the first 3 months that they're with us. And that's just enough, I would say, to, you know, I would say for food and transportation, that's about it. But, you know, just a little bit of security there. And even if they don't make it, like, again, like, you know, they could always go back to whatever job or whatever other job that seems interesting to them if they are really good at what they do. So they shouldn't have any trouble getting another job if they needed to. Antler helps them with that by, you know, leveraging our networks. If, for instance, a founder is unable to get to a point where they're able to raise money from the Antler Fund, you know, that's still fine. They can have another shot at, you know, the following batch after, or if they feel like, you know, they're going to go back to working a job before they try again, you know, we also try to make sure that we can connect them with a firm that's a really good fit, you know, mutually. So that's kind of, I guess, the advice that I would give people. Like, you know, if like, you know, a lot of people don't have a lot to lose. I mean, definitely less to lose than what they might actually think.
And Jiho, for people out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you or connecting with you in person, what would be the best point of contact? It's my understanding you are also on the verge of email bankruptcy.
That's, yeah, I mean, I have to like commit probably like a day or two, like every 2 weeks, to make sure that, you know, my inbox is in order. But I would advise people to follow me on LinkedIn. You can, you know, search me, Geo King, Antler, I should come up. And feel free to, you know, connect via LinkedIn. I try to be as responsive there. And it's good because I can kind of silo out people that are reaching out randomly versus like my work inbox. And if there are, I guess, people that I don't previously have a relationship with reaching out through my inbox, it's a lot more likely that they get buried in other emails. So, like, you know, using the LinkedIn channel actually gives you a better chance of getting my attention.
Jiho, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Hope to do this again sometime.
This podcast is brought to you by PyTone, an Asian-based open source enterprise software company. PyTone offers a suite of software applications and infrastructure services to scholars and universities.